the interplay of those energies and pain and pleasure and things like that can be fun, but I'm not Jeffrey Dahmer out here. There's nobody tied up in my bedroom ready to be murdered.
Not today.
Not today. Nobody's tied up today.
Hey guys, it's Kat and we're here with Baron to talk about BDSM.
Hi.
So what is BDSM?
BDSM is a complicated acronym that stands for bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism. And it encompasses a whole wide variety of different fetishes and kinks and different things that people do. Everything from hold me down or spank me all the way up to hang me by hooks from the ceiling and spin me around. BDSM is a subset of paraphilias, which are alternate sexual practices. They're things that aren't necessarily associated with sex directly. They're things that go outside of that, but still have a sexual or some form of excitement for them.
So are you saying that BDSM isn't necessarily about sex?
BDSM can and often is a sexual practice, but in a lot of ways it's also not. I often liken it to things like going to the gym. Some people go to the gym to get a hot rockin' body for the beach. Some people go to the gym because they need a stress relief. Some people go to the gym because it's a spiritual practice. And some people just go to the gym because we want to post gym selfies on Instagram, right? I have some partners where we have no sex, but we have only kinky play. And we call it play. And that's a very important thing. It is play. It's a form of self-expression that is meant to bring enjoyment and pleasure, but also help explore and express things that we can't do in normal ways. Just like when you were little, if you had dolls or if you had trucks and you ran around and crashed your trucks or you pretended to be a fire person or you wanted to play construction or something like that with Lincoln Logs, you were mimicking or taking on something in the outside world and kind of containing it in a controlled environment. So that's what, when we call it play, that's what we're doing.
So like, what is dominant and submissive?
So dominant and submissive is the most traditional kind of relationship style in a sense. The dominant person typically is a person who provides a sense of protection, guidance, coverage, focus and drive within the relationship, whereas a submissive party is a person who kind of handles a lot more of they're a lot more of the engine, the motor. They keep things moving forward, acts of service, acts of contrition, acts of subservience. So it can take the form of everything from control. So control over wardrobe is a big popular one. Control over sexual pleasure, orgasm, or masturbatory control is very popular in the community. And that could be a widespread day-to-day thing. So every day it's a matter of I get to say what you wear every day. Or it could be something where it's just one time. We're going to a dungeon, you put on that dress and you're gonna look great, right? Mm. Typically what happens is you have an interchange of power between the two. It's called power exchange. Power exchange.
And that's kind of what BDSM is about.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah. And there's levels, there's light power exchange all the way up to total power exchanges. Like we talked about master and slave, where the other person says, I don't want to have any control or agency over my life. I want you to.
So like you've mentioned master and slave. Are there people where like they live their entire life that way? Like you've mentioned there's things people do for play, but are there people that's how they live, period? Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Definitely, yeah. Just like there are people who go to the gym once a week and there are people who are CrossFit, devotees. Everybody has a little bit of a different thing. But yeah, some people live in 24/7 relationships. They're called lifestyle relationships where it's a part of their everyday operation. And it may be as simple as like every day when you wake up, you kneel at your master or mistress's feet and they say some form of devotion to you, or you may be practicing some kind of, there's positions you can be in and all sorts of little disciplines throughout. Or it can be, yeah, like you are just a normal everyday couple and then Friday night you go out and beat the living daylights out of each other and tie each other up and then come home and have great sex and then go back. Sunday morning you're at brunch with your friends again. That can be very healthy and beautiful or deeply unhealthy and ugly, right? Mm-hmm. And it depends on how it plays out. There's dominant women. There's a lot of dominant women out there. Wonderful, talented, skilled, amazing women who have these relationships.
Mm-hmm. And so women can be dominant too. It's not like a gendered thing where women are submissive, men are dominant. It's not always like that.
No, it's not.
Is everyone like solidly dominant or submissive? Like, is that like, do you have to pick one?
Yeah. So some people will tell you that. Mm-hmm. it's the same thing as like being bisexual. They're like, oh, you just haven't found it out.
Yeah.
I'm more of a switch than anything else.
Okay.
I identify as kinkster, which means that I enjoy a wide variety of kinky activities. Oftentimes that means I'm on top. Sometimes it means I'm on bottom. We also have top-bottom power dynamics, just like a lot of other communities do. For us, the top is the one who gives the thing, and the bottom is the one who takes it.
Oh, okay.
You don't have to be one thing. You can be whatever makes sense to you. I know people who are deeply submissive, so in their relationship dynamics, they're always service-oriented. They're very driven around pleasing the other person. They're very driven around, they love being told what to do. But they're also really sadistic. So when it comes down to it, they might not enjoy being in charge and giving commands, but giving someone pain, that level of power exchange they might enjoy. So everyone has a little bit of a different thing. Your experience is up to you. And oftentimes as people grow, they actually move along and change their role. So you might start as a sub because it's easy, or as a bottom, super easy to get everything and all you have to do is just process it. But then as you get more comfortable, you might say, oh, I want to switch, or I want to top.
Yeah.
Or go the other direction. I started out very dominant and then just became more comfortable in my sexuality.
Ah.
I was like, all right, maybe you stick it in me this time.
If you are bottoming for someone, does that mean that they are your dom? How does that work? Like, is there a difference between being someone's submissive or being like just a bottom?
There can be a big difference. You are submissive to the person you choose to be submissive to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of talk of like, once you submit, can you go back? And it's like, yeah, you're a human being. You still have autonomy and agency. You can change your mind. Like that is an underpinning current of what we do. Sexual freedom is about recognizing personal agency. So you don't have to be the person submissive. You don't have to submit to bottom, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to submit to get spanked or tied up. We talk a lot about how the bottom has power because the bottom can say no, the bottom can stop the scene, the bottom can safe word.
Really? So even though the bottom is in a submissive position, they still have some degree of power, I guess, over the dominant person?
Mm-hmm. Well, because the idea of submission comes from the word submit, which is a verb, an action word. So to submit is to take an action of submitting, right? Because there's submit and then there's like forced subservience, right? This is not enforced slavery. We don't have somebody putting a boot to our necks and selling us to do it. It is an active choice we make.
Mm-hmm.
And so by making that active choice, you have every right to withdraw that active choice. If you're in a situation or a scene and you're not feeling submissive towards the person, but you're liking what they're doing, they're skilled and they are capable, then no, you're not a submissive. You're just enjoying an experience. And it's okay to be a bottom or a submissive and to have things that are focused on you.
What sort of person, like, why do you think people turn to BDSM? What is appealing to a lot of people about BDSM?
The great question of the ages, right?
Yeah, why?
I think in large part, there tend to be a lot of, kinky people are a wide variety of different people. There are doctors and lawyers and professionals. It's funny, you'll be in a dungeon, you'll see this guy, and he's, like, commanding the whole room, and he's, like, you know, ready to like whip the most gorgeous girl on the planet, and he just seems like such a dude, and he's the guy, and you know, like talking to him, he's like, yeah, I gotta go to work at 6:30 tomorrow, I'm up floors at the school, right? And you go into another room and you see this like woman, and she's like a human ashtray, and she's like, oh yeah, I got the week off, you know, I don't have any surgeries, oh, I'm a neurosurgeon, by the way, you know?
Yeah.
So like your expectations are shattered, in a sense. And there's always this idea of like, you know, the media has presented like, big powerful men, and then they go like to be a sissy maid for some dominatrix at a dungeon. It happens.
Do you find that that's true? Like that
sometimes.
A lot of times people who embody some degree of power and influence want to be on the opposite side of it.
Yeah. And that can be a valid thing. I think for anybody who's in control all day long, you know, we talk about like the willpower being limited and there's a lot of science about whether or not that's true. And we're still learning about it. But I think there is a sense of release for a lot of people in this, that there's something in their ongoing consistent vanilla or daily life that they seek release from.
So what exactly appealed to you initially about BDSM? Like, why did you start getting into the BDSM community?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a very conservative Christian home, traditional middle class, white, WASPy Christian family. And church was a big part of what we did. My dad's family was very involved in the church that they're a part of, and so for us it was a big part of identity. And for me, I had a lot of strange and different feelings that I couldn't quite comprehend or understand or explain. And even when I was little, certain power-related and pain-related games were part of my play. You know, I enjoyed playing like, you know, cops and robbers, tie me up type of a situation, you know? I enjoyed that power dynamic a little. I mean, obviously when you're a child, it's a little more innocent and it's something that is kind of, you're just trying to figure out how the world works. As my sexuality developed, it started to come more and more and more part of it. I remember I was early up in the dial-up internet days when you had to wait for the... You valued every boob and penis you saw on the internet because it took so freaking long to get there. I remember at clicking on a link that I didn't, I just saw a thumbnail and I didn't know what it was and it looked like an interesting color and I was just kind of, I was like 14, 15 and I'm just kind of clicking around on the internet. Just suddenly I saw this image of a woman who was like hogtied on a red bed, big giant four-poster bed with like satin bed sheets and she was wearing a corset. She was hogtied with red rope and a big red ball gag. And I just instantly, something clicked, you know, like, and I, like, you can tell I clicked because I remember the image very well.
Yeah, that's vivid.
Yeah, so I remember that and it clicked and something clicked and I was like, oh, that's a thing. And of course, when you're that age and you're still exploring, like, none of it makes sense. You're like, what does this mean? And I went through many years of shame. I went to a Christian high school. I went to a Bible college. I actually were required to sign a morality statement that says no drinking, no sex, no drugs.
And you did all of that.
Yeah. When I hit college, I moved out. I was no longer, my parents were no longer there to kind of be like a voice. And you always assume your parents know what's going on.
Yeah.
And then you hit your 30s and you're like.
And you realize they don't know anything. They don't know what's going on at all.
Why did they lie to me? Yeah. I hit a point where I just kind of needed to move in a direction that was more true to myself. So we have, just like, you know, in the gay community and a lot of other communities, alternative lifestyles, we have outings too.
When you say outings, you mean like coming out as someone who's into BDSM?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it can come out. And we also have unwelcome outings, in which is my case. So I had somebody, to my parents and too many people in my life, find out that I was doing this and reached out to them and said, here's what he's doing. Now, my mom was amazing and continues to be supportive to this day in each
great.
And every way. Yeah, she's still, you know, she's still Christian. She's very much into the church. Mm-hmm. But she's also very gracious and loving about it. She's like, I accept who you are. I love you for who you are. I'm not going to judge you or tell you how to live your life, which is wonderful.
That is good.
But so when that came out, it kind of became one of these things of, I had to make a decision and assess in my life of, is this something that's important enough to me to risk things that are, you know, potential and possibility to me to be out and about it? And I was 22, 23 at the time and felt like I could take on the whole world and felt invincible. So I said, yeah, let's go for it. So I started to be very public and vocal about it.
Like, has being out, has that changed your life? Has it made certain things harder?
The cultural weight that a lot of minority groups and a lot of oppressed people face isn't there with kinky people. Because, like I said, we can hide it. Also, it's one of those things where the attitude is kind of like, well, as long as it's not in my face, it's fine, whatever, right? But there have been moments where it has impacted my life and I had to have that conversation with myself. I prefer to live as fearlessly as I possibly can and to be as out as things, about things as I can. You know, I'm also bisexual, I'm polyamorous, and so all these things have kind of collected into a sense of like, I'm different, and that's okay, I'm happy with that. And for me, a large part of it was, A, I did deal with some shame from my family as they kind of adjusted to the idea. My mom brought up, she was like, you know, your dad and I, when we saw the porn that you looked at when you were younger, you know, whenever we caught you, we kind of had an idea that you might have a theme, a through line in your interests, right? For her, it wasn't like a shock, but for my dad, it was a huge shock, and it was kind of a thing that he struggled with for a while. I had a partner who is now a very dear friend. We didn't quite work out, but her parents, very Catholic. I mean, we're talking anti-abortion bumper stickers all over the back of their Subaru.
Are you telling me that like Catholics are kinky with the mea culpa and all that? You're just like, I'm shocked.
Well, these ones aren't.
Okay, they're
many,
not.
Many are. Many Catholics and Mormons are very freaky people.
Not all.
But a good
number. Send me letters.
Yeah, and her very Catholic family found out what she was doing. She had a partner. They're open. They participate in swingers parties and kinky play, and they throw their own parties. And had pictures out online. There's a website called FetLife, which is kind of the Facebook of kinky people.
Okay.
It's one of many places to go, but it's kind of become the kind of central tent pole of the social media world when it comes to being kinky. And there are pictures up there. And FetLife has taken some precautions to prevent people from, like, you know, finding this information. Because a lot of people, it's private. It's something, like I said, that has to be kept under wraps. And unfortunately, her parents found out a lot of it.
Oh no, they found her FetLife page?
Yeah, and his, and found a bunch of stuff and photos.
That's
and
so
published
horrifying.
A long email and sent it out to everyone who knew
Why would they do that?
Because she has a child, and they were worried that the child was being negatively influenced by this.
Okay.
She lost her child for a while.
Wow.
It took her away, and she had to basically prove it. Actually, she had to end relationships because the story that was being presented was they're part of a sex cult.
Wow.
And that actually is a kind of a common occurrence actually for a number of people. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because it's not a constant thing. Like I said, it never came up. Eventually it came to pass that this is not something you can take a child away for. She earned her daughter's back, but there's still that constant fear and trauma. Yeah. I grew up in a community where, like, on one hand, you know, if you go right, you end up at like a witch's coven with a bunch of lesbians growing pot. And if you go left, you end up at like a white, you know, nationalist.
Well, I'm going right.
Yeah, go right. Go right to the witches. They have the best weed and good wine. So there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of people who work for the federal government, for the state government, for the city, and all of them have like morality clauses in their employment contracts. So there was a number of people who are deeply concerned about being outed or publicly shown as a person.
Because it's going to negatively impact
their career. Yeah. Exactly. They might lose their job. They might lose their career. You know, many of these people have worked years. I mean, if you're a therapist, you've worked 6, 8, 10 years worth of school to get where you're at, masters and et cetera. And this could, just like that, totally ruin your credibility because everyone assumes, all right, well now you like being spanked and dressing up in heels as a man, you must be some kind of weirdo or freak, right? Something's wrong with you. And so there's a lot of people where it is a very big, deep concern. They don't want to come out. And that's one of the reasons, like, I try to be so public is because I have faced some of those challenges. I'm very fortunate that I haven't faced very many as far as that goes. My boss right now, if he saw this, he would be like, I saw you on YouTube.
Great. That's really good.
I didn't know that was, and then he'd ask like 20 questions and then it would be it, right?
So if you're interested in doing a scene, how would you negotiate it? Like, how would that go?
Proactive, consent-driven negotiation, which is, I would like to do this. I would not like to do this. These are what we call, we have limits. Limits is basically don't do this, you know, don't pull my hair because when I was growing up, my grandma pulled my hair and when she beat me, right?
Yeah.
So like that's a triggering thing, right? Or I'm just not comfortable with calling you daddy, right? That's a weird thing for some people and a big deal for other people, right? And so we express these limits to each other. So understanding how that works, how that conversation works, and then it's not just a matter of like, please don't beat the shit out of me and rape me. Like, it's not just a request of, like, please don't treat me terribly. It's literally a conversation between two consenting adults working out and hashing out a shared experience and a shared possibility. You know, talk about outcomes. Talk about possible areas of you know, triggering and vulnerabilities, and talk about a lot of different things. So become familiar with those things a little bit. Do your homework. There's a lot of great resources. There's ratings on FetLife. There's Kink Academy online, Twitter, Instagram. There's a lot of different things. There's some really great people who talk about sex coaching and things like that, consent and things. They're not hard to find. Google it. It's very easy to find. And it's all over Tumblr. So
Tumblr. Reliable epic resource.
Reliable Tumblr. If you go out into the community and you're trying to look for a partner, look for someone who is willing to be upfront and honest. If somebody, just like it's not okay to like go in and have sex with someone and have them be like, by the way, halfway through I took off the condom or I removed the prophylactic, right? That's not okay. Same thing as changing in the middle of the scene and being like, I know we didn't talk about doing paddles, but I decided to do a paddle with you, right?
It's not
you
cool. Paddle.
Not cool, right?
Yeah.
So find people who are honest and upfront about their intentions. Ask about their history. Ask about references. We talk about references in our community. Sometimes they can be overblown, right?
Yeah.
Everybody. Oh, he's a great guy. I'm shocked that he was an abusive person. I'm shocked at these allegations. Bill Cosby. Everyone thought Bill Cosby was obviously the best guy in the world, right?
Yeah.
So reputation isn't everything. Referrals, references aren't everything. Still got to be cautious, but they're a good indicator. If you are looking at someone and they're like, oh, I've been doing this for 15 years, and you're like, great. How long was your longest relationship? Do you know anybody who you've been around and played with for that long? Mm. Right? Because if you've been around for 15 years and you haven't had any partner in 6 years that has lasted for longer than a month, that might say something about your maturity or health or ability to handle these things.
Yeah.
So have those conversations too. Talk a little bit about their history and their past. You don't need to necessarily make it an interrogation. You don't need to grill them and be like, where were you 3 years
just
ago?
Just ask them, what's
going on? Yeah. And if they're kind of trying to bypass those conversations, probably a big red flag.
It's a red flag, yeah.
But you don't need to like jump into it right now with both feet. So take a step back, take a deep breath.
Go
if someone
slow.
Gives you, yeah, go slow. If someone gives you a weird prickly feeling on the back of your neck or you play once, one of the things I get is, well, the first time we played, everything was fine. And then we played again and I went over to his house or she invited me to like this private event and then suddenly things got weird, right? So don't let one time of play be like, everything's fine. You know, he didn't touch me inappropriate there. Pay attention to those things and pay attention to little signs too. Little signs beget big signs. And across any sexual experience, but especially with kink, is little things beget big things, right? And if there is no pause when you say, I'm new, be honest about being new because it's a very different experience.
Yeah.
Right? For me, who's somebody who this is a normal, consistent activity in my life versus somebody who's just getting into it, it'd be like going to a running group and you have a bunch of people who run ultra marathons and you're like, I can run long distance. Right? And you're like, I've never run more than a mile, right?
Yeah.
But 10 minutes into that run, you're going to be dead and they're going to be gone. Right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Be honest about being new and say, hey, I'm just getting into this. I'm just trying to learn. And if they don't respond to that with kind of an openness and a kind of an additional level of care, or if they get overly excited, or if that's something that they seem to focus on, then they're probably looking at you as like, you're new. Mm. You're inexperienced. You're, you know, vulnerable. You're naive. And I can take and capitalize on that. So
yeah.
Having that conversation is important. And then trust your instinct. Trust your gut. Like I said, that's why you want to learn about a variety of different versions and kinds of kink and a variety of different ways of being. It's because then you don't feel like, am I doing this wrong? Am I making a mistake? Is it me? You know, just in any situation where there's that kind of question, you know. You hear it in sexual assault cases. Like, did I do something wrong? Did I bring this on myself? So knowing that can help you avoid that pitfall of asking yourself that question and ignoring a big red flag.
Yeah.
Right? Because people who do that will often say, no, this is how it's always done.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. 90% of the time, it's not. And you have that problem and you have it happen all the time because you are not a mature, responsible, capable person.
Yeah.
So just pay attention to those little red flags and your instincts. There's a little person that lives right here that it's very loud sometimes.
Yeah.
Don't ignore that.
When it comes to approaching someone, especially if you're like a submissive person, approaching a dominant person, like what are some red flags that you would see from a dom?
And anybody who focuses entirely too much on new people. Mm-hmm. People who often have significant age gaps in their relationships, right?
Yeah.
But every partner they have is new, is young, is basically like a long list of like, you know, you go to their FetLife profile and there's 32 pictures and all of them are a different woman and all of them obviously, you know, they're wearing Lululemon yoga pants and 23-year-old Instagram model looking and none of them last for more than 2 pictures. Probably a pattern of behavior there, and you're gonna be the next one on that list, right? If they don't talk about safe words or about some form of way of saying stop, when I play with someone for the first time, I tell them, we have safe words, they're red, or whatever we go with, because you always wanna have a safety valve, just in case. But also, I listen to stop, I listen to no, I listen to don't, I listen to your body language. Mm-hmm. If you want, some people like to play with stop doesn't mean stop.
Yeah.
But
you've had a conversation where you understand that when they say that, that's what that is.
Exactly. That's a dangerous road to walk down if you haven't had that conversation, right? Because you can't tell the difference between no, stop, and no, stop all the time.
Yeah.
In that moment. And when you get into a certain headspace, there's a lot of headspace here. You get into the headspace, and that's the goal, to get in the headspace of power exchange. And when you get into that headspace, it can get difficult to say no to the person.
Yeah.
And having a safe word is kind of an agreement of, I might not be able to say no to you, but I can always stop this. Ignoring your concerns or ignoring the need for care for you as a newbie or ignoring your negotiation can be a very big sign of like, okay, this person, if this person can't get this in a conversation, they're not gonna get it when they're in a situation of power.
I've heard a lot about men in the BDSM community being abusive, like using BDSM to hide, you know, their abusive tendencies and things like that.
It is important to highlight there is abuse, there's misogyny and sexism and racism and transphobia and whorephobia and homophobia all across, just like any community. With us, some of those gender and race power dynamics play out very differently because power is a part of what we do. Social power is a part of how we operate, because if you're in a dominant and submissive relationship, one person, the dominant, has been given by choice and consent generally by the other person more power and control. And that can often play out. There is a fetish around 1950s housewife role play. Now, obviously, you don't want to actually be a 1950s housewife on Fen Fen, waking up at 4:30 in the morning to put on makeup so your husband never has to see you without your face on, being abused, being talked down to, and never having any authority or power in your life. Like, obviously not entirely realistic there, but there is a lot of that played out in what we do. And I try very hard to focus on making sure that when I am in that role as a male, masculine presenting person, that I respect that. But not everybody does. And there are a lot of people out there who are abusive, who are out to get something.
So, like, all this talk about BDSM has made me a little curious about, like, what you do in terms of BDSM stuff. So what are some of the, like, the tools and the things that you use to do the thing?
I mean, we play with toys. We have what's called pervertibles. So, for example, I have, this is one of my favorites. This is an IKEA cheese board.
Oh, wow.
$7. Yeah, I use it as a paddle. I hit people with it. This is used for what's called impact play.
Okay.
Which is anytime you strike another person with an object. Hand, cane, paddle, anything. It's one of the most common forms of play. It can be both pleasurable, so like I have floggers here.
Floggers. Those are so pretty.
Thank you. These are leather floggers. You got a handle. This is the hitting end down here, and this is the swinging end. I love flogging because it's kind of a low risk way to learn about these things, and it's a skill that's not difficult to master. A lot of people can. It provides confidence for somebody who's new, and it provides a very dynamic play experience. It's really easy to incorporate into most play, and it's a good tool for getting somebody into pain or impact. But they're made out of leather. They typically have multiple what are called falls or tails. You may hear a cat of nine tails, which is a nine-tailed one. Whips are typically single, like this. So single tail is what it's called. And then floggers have anywhere from 12 to about 50, depending upon how much you want. Typically 30 to 40 falls is what most have. And they're swung a little like this. It's called a figure eight. Hopefully I don't hit the ceiling here. And then there's some of the showier stuff that I do. The Florentine is what it's called, just based on spinning techniques. And then there's the overhead pinwheel, right? And then there's the underhanded Florentine. And then there's a whole different variety of different things you can do with it. but you hit people with these and it creates a sensation. One of the things that people don't quite understand about it is that this isn't always necessarily painful to be pleasurable. Like a massage. A massage is both pain and enjoyable.
Okay.
Right? And it's both tension and release. These are fun. Dowel rod. Doesn't cost a lot of money, but makes a pretty big impact. Chains. Very useful. Rope. So just stick your, this is called a two column tie, because you got two columns here, right? Wrist tie, this is pretty basic bondage right here.
Okay.
Bondage is actually relatively simple if you know what you're doing, but it's also very dangerous if you don't. So learn from good, the Naughty Boys have some good books, there's a lot of good resources online if you want to. But basically we take our bite, it's a rope term, it's a loop, loop it around here. You pull this through. Notice there's not a knot necessarily. It's technically a knot, but it's not. It's not knot, not a knot. Line it up, loop it back around. All right, make sure your ropes line up. Pull this back through. This rope's a little long, but I enjoy the effect it has. It's hemp rope. You can get hemp rope pretty easily from bulk distributors or online. Nylon also works. Composite works pretty well. Nylon does stretch. A lot of people like hemp or jute because it's resilient and it doesn't break easily, but it also doesn't stretch a lot. Nylon does. And then one more loop. It's a little rough. There's some very, very pretty pictures online if you ever go looking for shibari or kinbaku. Have a nice tie. Just attach this to the bedpost or the ceiling. See, that was easy. No. And then all I need to do is just pull this out. hemp everywhere. That's legal in California now.
Yeah, it's totally legal.
Totally
so we're
legal.
Fine.
Hemp everywhere. Sensation play is kind of the other end of things where you're playing with sensation. And really what it is you're playing with an experience mm-hmm. that's shared between two people just throughout the entire thing for being kinky. And so sensation play can be the same thing. And pleasure can be too much, right? Mm-hmm. You can have too much enjoyment. Like when yeah. you're laughing really hard and suddenly you hit the point of like, I need to stop laughing.
Yeah.
You know, it's painful, right? Same thing with this. Pleasure can be painful too. Orgasms can be painful if you know what you're doing.
if you want them to be.
If you want them to be, yeah. and sometimes on accident, but that's why you learn. This is part of why we have a community is because these things require skills and mm-hmm. practice and shared knowledge, right? If you want to do fire play is one, knife play is another, called edge play. They're things that are have an inherent danger that goes outside the normal acceptable risk, right?
So like, do you have any edge play things? Because that sounds scary.
A little bit. I have this nice, this is a snake whip.
Wow.
This is actually, so we talk about healthy relationships. This was made by my children's stepdad, who was also in the community.
That's so
sweet. It was
a
gift. Yeah. So, and BDSM was one of the ways which we were able to connect and kind of cross the bridge of father, stepfather tension that's usually there. And so this was kind of one of his things. So this is considered a little more edgy.
So like that, the sensation you would get from that is going to be different from the sensation you get from the flogger, right?
Significantly, yes. Okay. So this is more of a sting.
Okay.
The floggers can have some stinginess to them, but they're more thuddy is the word we use, or bitey is another one where kind of between the two, right?
So there are probably some people who like thuddy and there are some
yes,
people who like sting.
Absolutely.
And there are people who probably like maybe a mixture of both.
Both, yeah.
Interesting.
And it depends on where you're at. Some people really like thuddy during just pure sadomasochistic play, but then during sex they like stingy. Right?
You know? Interesting.
Like I don't like scratching, but when, or I do like scratching, but like okay. when we're having sex and you scratch me, like I'm gonna be like, whoa. Take a breath. Hold on, that was a little much for me. But so everyone has a little bit of a different need base as far as those different types of sensation goes. And yeah, they're going to be a little different, and the risk factor is a little different. With a flogger, I haven't heard of a lot of serious injuries or bodily harm reported from flogging. But a lot of other things, knife play for one.
People can get seriously harmed.
Injury. Yeah.
Interesting. So like what's like give me like a story of a person or a thing you know of where someone got like seriously harmed. Because
yeah.
obviously that's a concern for a lot of people when they're entering into BDSM is like no one wants to go and have like irreversible damage done to them at a dungeon.
No.
Theoretically.
Theoretically.
I don't know.
Some people do.
Some people I'm sure.
And if you're into that, awesome.
Great. No shame at all.
No shame. No
None.
Shame. And people do. There's branding, there's scarring, like I said, mm-hmm. hanging from hooks. There's a number of stories. There's people who do self-bondage and then get stuck. Like, let me get handcuffs. I have handcuffs. Mine are what's called double locking. So these are my handcuffs.
Huh.
These are police grade handcuffs. Mine are made by my Valor. They provide handcuffs for security companies.
Do they really? Wow.
Yeah. And
those are real handcuffs.
These are real handcuffs.
I'm so used to seeing like the furry ones
these
from
are real,
Spencer's.
Real cuffs. So they make the click and everything. But one of the things is that handcuffs keep getting tighter.
Yeah.
If you have a hand in here, you can't swing it all the way around, right?
Yeah.
So I have my keys. This is my little key ring. I've got all my little keys on here. It's my in and out safety pin. At one point I was a good old American
yeah.
in and out
That's
boy.
So
yeah.
funny. Yeah.
So I keep the keys on this because you always want your keys around because this is steel and it locks, right?
Yeah.
So I have my handcuff key here. And what a double locking handcuff is right, if I put this on a wrist and it starts to get really tight, it can cause circulation problems, all sorts of things. People who do self bondage, this happens. They get cheap handcuffs from Amazon. And they don't take the normal precautions that they should. So what these do, these have a little pin in here. You push the little pin in.
Oh, wow.
Now it locks.
Stay
right?
there.
They stay there, right?
Oh, wow.
So they're called double locking handcuffs. And then I take my key, and when I unlock, the other thing is when you use handcuffs, make sure you know where your keyhole are. Because if they get confused and twisted, then things happen.
Yeah.
It can be very painful to get them off your partner if they get stuck. But that's important because if you got this one here, and it gets too tight, especially when you go to unlock it, it can actually make it tighter and it can actually cause additional harm or it can make it really hard. And when you're trying to unlock handcuffs in a panic because your partner's freaking out, not a fun time.
Yeah.
Or if you're by yourself, don't use handcuffs by yourself unless you have the proper safety precautions. If you don't know what they are, then you shouldn't be doing it.
Wow.
If I need to tell you on a YouTube video, you shouldn't be doing
probably
it.
Probably not, yeah.
Probably not the time. But you see this is stuck and then if I turn both directions, now it frees itself.
Nice.
And it goes back to this. So I double locking handcuffs, making sure you're safe. So I've heard stories of people who used regular handcuffs. They got too tight. They couldn't get to the key and they were stuck for a weekend. In bed, Gerald's Game style.
Wow, yeah, I was thinking that a Stephen King novel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that happens. When you take the proper precautions, it doesn't happen as much, but it can happen.
So do your research.
Do your research.
And know who you're playing
with. Accept your risks, know who you're playing with, and make sure that if you are going to take that kind of risk, that you have fairly great health care, but B, you always need to know if you're going to do a play. So if you do fire play, you got to have an
extinguisher. Fire play.
Fire play. Yeah.
Like play with fire.
Yeah, you use chemicals and you create fire and flame on people's skin and you play with heat and interchange. You can do fire cupping is another thing where you use like Chinese fire cups where you actually take a cup and you light it on the inside on fire and put it on someone's skin and the extinguishing of the flame actually creates a vacuum and sucks the skin in.
Wow.
Yeah. Fire, electricity, wax play. There's a
electricity
lot of
play. Electricity play. People get shocked and that's like a kink for them.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, like the tens pads that you put when you have a back injury, you can put those all over the body and create all sorts of sensations.
Interesting.
Things like violet wands and things like that create static electricity.
What are violet wands?
Violet wands.
Is that a Harry Potter thing?
Yeah, kind of. no, it's the thing you plug in, it creates a static discharge. It's just a little bulb. It looks kind of like a Tesla coil on the inside. You know when you go and you touch those things and they make lightning and
stuff? Like the light thing,
Basically those, but attenuated to create a lot more static.
So it's just like static all over your body.
Yeah, pretty much. And if you focus that right, it can create some cool sensations. But all these things, making sure you have the safety precautions. If you do fire play, have a fire extinguisher nearby, have a blanket. Mm-hmm. Know the chemicals you're using, because there's a bunch of different chemicals you can use. Make sure you understand, test those on someone's skin first, right?
Yeah.
If you're doing knife play, make sure you have gauze. Actually, always make sure you have gauze. Gauze saves lots of lives. Mm-hmm. Public service announcement, always carry medical gauze. and tape and things like that. Make sure you put a towel down if you're doing wax play, because you will fuck up your carpet and then your landlord will take your deposit.
Wow.
True story.
Speaking from your own experience.
Maybe. but just being prepared and making sure you're safe. And if you're doing it with someone else, it's the same thing of like, if you go home with someone from a bar and you have condoms and they have condoms, then you have a pretty good understanding that they're careful as you are.
Yeah.
If you show up and they're like, I don't use condoms, you know, and you're like, well, maybe Google's pull back a little bit because you're a stranger, right?
Totally
if
makes
you
sense.
Don't like using condoms and you take those risks, no shame. But, you know, it's the same kind of thing. If you come into a situation and you're prepared and they're prepared, you're double prepared.
Yeah. So I'm curious of how you, as someone who is in the BDSM community, felt about specifically Hollywood's portrayal of BDSM in the books and the film of Fifty Shades of Grey.
Fifty Shades. Yeah. Yes. 50 Shades of Grey. Yeah. So that was an interesting moment in our cultural history. It was a very bittersweet moment for a lot of kinky people because it was a social acceptance of kink as kind of a part of a romantic relationship, right? Mm-hmm. On another level, there was a lot of behaviors in there that we in our own community fight against that were abusive, controlling, manipulative behaviors that throughout, you know, the interaction, especially in a male and female relationship dynamic with misogyny and sexism and the overarching sense of you know, men being in power, powerful men doing powerful man things, it was really difficult for us to kind of unpack that with people and to be like, look, I get that you're into 50 Shades, but that's not what we do, right? There's parts of it that we do, right? I've texted dirty texts to my partners. I've had a dungeon in my home, you know?
Yeah.
I've had all these things. But the kind of, it was on one sense very honest in its portrayal of a very damaged, psychologically unhealthy person and their relationship with this person who was new and naive. So in that sense, great story.
Accurate.
Very accurate, good morality tale, but it wasn't presented as a morality tale. Right? It was presented as, this is a romantic relationship. Every girl wants a guy who will tell her what to wear and then fly her off and then bitch at her about some terrible thing in his past and then disappear for forever, right?
Yeah.
And then come back and sweep her off her feet again. Like, that's what every woman wants. Not true at all. but for us, it was one of those things of like, we always collectively sigh whenever we hear 50 Shades of Grey. We're like, But I think a large part of the animosity is just directed at this general, like, we're yelling at the abyss saying, like, this is not who we are. And most people are like, well, we weren't here for the kinky parts. We were just here because it was sexy. There's a lot more positive kind of models out there in the media now that are coming out that have allowed us to feel a little more comfortable with the fact that, like, Hollywood gets it. And the fact of the matter is, looking you straight in the eye, there are a lot of kinky people in Hollywood. They may pretend they're not, but there's a lot of kinky people out there.
So there are some people who have said that BDSM has a way of reinforcing very, like, misogynistic views of what, you know, women should do and what men should do. Do you think that there is, I guess I would say, a widespread misogyny issue within the BDSM community at large?
I think, just like any subculture that's part of a culture, we inherit both the positives and negatives of the culture.
Yeah.
Right? And in America and in the Western world, yeah, we do have a big misogyny problem. We have a big race problem as well. And those both actually present themselves in the BDSM community to some extent sometimes. And it's true. We're not perfect. Our community is far from perfect. And we're working very hard, a lot of us are, not all of us, but at correcting that. So I think in a way, yes, it does, because it's a fantasy, it's a chance to take a reality and make a very shiny, intense version of it. And so yeah, like I said, there's 1950 housewife portrayals and things like that. And if you're not careful, yes, they can dip into sexist, misogynistic, anti-female violence, in a sense, anti-woman sentiments. Anybody who is interested in gender politics, though, it is an opportunity to see a really great microcosm of that play out in a controlled environment where people are exploring it with the intent of knowing that this is an exploration of kind of an extreme version of
reality. It's play. Yeah.
And like I said, it can get very real, but it is an opportunity to kind of poke at it. Same thing with, like, violence and destruction and even traumatic experiences. An opportunity to unpack it in a controlled way. And it's an opportunity to also be like, hey, we have these roles in society that are ingrained. How much of this is okay for me to want? Mm-hmm. How much of it is not?
Yeah.
You know? It's a really good opportunity to dive in and delve into those things, but it can get unhealthy fast. So yeah, there's definitely an opportunity to keep growing there for our community.
Some people who are critical of BDSM would say that we should really focus on why we have such an obsession with sexualizing violence. Mm-hmm. What would you sort of say about people who are sort of worried about, you know, because I've often heard when people criticize BDSM, this idea of, like, especially when it comes to people who are doing it out of trauma, that it's like a band-aid for a wound and not really healing it. It's like perpetuating issues. Like, what would you say as a response to that?
I think that's a very good thing to actually keep in mind and to talk about. We do talk about it within our community a fair amount. And there are people who want to obviously just kind of sweep it under the rug and say it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. I think being vocal about it and talking about it is super important, because it is something that's very risky. And, like, it's easy for us, because we have this guise of power, and typically males end up in a dominant role and females in a submissive role because society says that's how it works. And it's hard to go against the stream. It does make it easier for us to, glorify sexual violence. And we do have events where there is some troublesome ideas behind it. You know, we have events that's like, oh, let's have a serial killer themed event or something like that. And I think for us, it is a matter of, on one hand, we are very aware of it. We talk about it a lot. Consent is a very big part of what we do, as is positive mental health. There are a lot of people who are dealing with traumas and who are, I mean, in any community, you have a lot of people who deal with sexual and trauma and violence and assault, just in everyday whatever, in situations. And for us, A, recognizing that that's a real thing that impacts your life constantly, no matter what you're doing, is important. But B, finding a healthy way to kind of process and express it. For many people, yes, they do use kink and BDSM to handle these traumatic experiences and this trauma, but it's a way for them to recapture and own it, in a sense.
To relive something and, like, make it, like, on their terms sort of situation?
Yeah, it can be like, hey, I want to relive this and I want to own the experience and have it be mine. Or it can be a matter of, I want this thing to be something that I enjoy, not to be a thing that this other person has taken from me. Right? Because you can't, oftentimes those traumas come from being part of the kink community, but not coming in a healthy way, finding someone who is abusive. And so for them, it's a matter of saying, I'm still this person, this is still a core part of my identity, but I am able to express it in a way that I control and I can reclaim that. I think one of the things that often gets lost in the shuffle is that Within BDSM, we borrow a lot of terminology from psychology and from sociology, like sadism, masochism, paraphilia. We call ourselves freaks and perverts and things like that. And a lot of that, it's similar to a lot of other communities that are kind of on the margins of society, wherein we take words that are typically meant to be some kind of derogatory or have negative connotations. We borrow them, we own them, we repurpose them, and we use them for ourselves. You know, when I say I'm a sadistic person, and I am, I enjoy the interaction of inflicting pain on someone.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, you know, and it's fun. Mm-hmm. The interplay of those energies and pain and pleasure and things like that can be fun, but I'm not Jeffrey Dahmer out here. There's nobody tied up in my bedroom ready to be murdered.
Not today.
Nobody's tied up today. Yeah. It's something that we use because it helps people understand where we're coming from. It's a commonly used term that gives us the ability to say, like, okay, you know, I'm not a sexual sadist in the sense of, like, I'm not gonna, like I said, run around and duct tape people and be like, ha ha ha, your pain is wonderful, right? I have an ethical compass that I follow, which includes consent. The biggest misconception that I struggle with is just that the idea that we're not healthy, functioning, normal people in most of our daily lives, or that there's something broken about us. We're not broken. I mean, no more than any other person is. I mean, we're all dealing with our own shit. But we're not somehow weird, freaky people. Mm-hmm. Another one is that this is not some sort of like manifestation of like a sexual obsession. Like we started with masturbation and porn, and then we, you know, just had to keep getting more and more intense as it goes on. My sexuality, like it's expanded, but I've never felt like I had to have a certain thing in order to get off, right? And I think that's something people just assume, like, oh, it's a fetishism, because psychologically, a fetish is something where you have a sexual fixation on a singular non-sexual object, like shoes or whatever, which can be healthy or unhealthy, depending upon how you work with it. But it's not a thing where I've, like, gone to a certain point and I can't come back again. It's more of a continual exploration of my boundaries and limitations. So I think that's a big misconception that frustrates a lot of people. We're not, manifesting some corner of depravity that we can't function in normal society. Mm-hmm. We're exploring a part of ourselves. Yeah. And then I think another thing is that kinky people are not able to have healthy, normal relationships. We are. Mm-hmm. I know people who've had, 20, 30 year long marriages that are very happy. I know people who have dated around and had a lot of fun. And I know people who are terribly unhealthy with relationships, but no more so than your average vanilla person. So those are some big things that I think a lot of people maybe either think or talk about, or maybe it's kind of the social conception that we've built around kinkiness that maybe not everyone believes, but people just buy into. We're normal people. We're people you work with. You've probably made jokes about us to us without realizing it. Mm. Those are the big things that really, everything else that comes out of every other misconception kind of comes from those basic things of like, what we do is weird, it's freaky, it's wrong, it's abnormal, it's broken. It is a little off the norm. It is kind of freaky, but kind of fun freaky. You know, I don't speak for everybody who's kinky.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who will disagree with me. See comments below.
There's going to be a lot.
A lot. But that's, and that's just goes to prove that like we're not.
It's diverse.
We're not a monolith. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there's no big kinky meeting that we go to every year where we all agree.
There's like, no cult. There's no underground cult.
There's no underground.
You guys have dungeons with you.
There's no underground cult.
Oh, okay.
Is that convincing?
I feel like if there wasn't an underground cult, like the thing you would say is that there wasn't an underground cult. So
yeah,
you never know.
You never know. Tom Cruise.
He's kink.
I've heard.
He's really into alien impregnation. Like, yes, he's super into that.
That's pretty freaky, guys.
And there's nothing wrong.
Nothing
with
wrong
that.
With that.
There's nothing wrong with.
Yeah,
that.
And that, I mean, that bugs me when you see people who are into these things and you have that public like backlash of like, oh well, I knew he was going to be off because you got all these stories of foot fetishism, right? Mm-hmm. Or like our president. One thing that bothers me is when people, it's called kink shaming. Mm-hmm. They kink shame some of the things that he was into. And for me, it's like, there are plenty of legitimate things to go after.
There's nothing wrong with being pissed on.
Right?
Nothing. There's no shame in it.
Yeah. There's no shame. There is, unless the fun shame could be.
But, true. But that's a kink.
That's a kink. But there's no public negative shame on it. If he wants to do that,
good for
Mr.
him.
Mr. President,
more power to him.
All right?
I hope you get peed on a lot and frequently.
Well, one of the few times you will hear me encourage him to do something, Mr. President, get your kink on, bro. Do it. But yeah, but I mean that bothers me a lot is when yeah. people use that as kind of, because that says
there are other things to attack.
Yeah, that says to me if I am ever in that position, they're gonna come to me and say, well, you know, he was into freaky dungeon stuff, and I'm like,
yeah.
Yes, I was. It was a healthy part of my life.
So if people want to find you, where can they find you?
So I spend a lot of time on Instagram.
Okay.
At Kinky Baron on Instagram. Instagram is my place to go. I love pictures. I think that. Being able to have the visuals to go with what I'm saying allows for a lot better representation and presentation and kind of makes it feel a little bit more normal. Honestly, if you want to talk about anything, have any questions or anything like that, reach out. I love talking to people about these things, and the more I can help people understand, the more opportunities we have to see this kind of become a thing where it's just, you know, it's an everyday thing. It's a normal thing. I want it to be relatively normal. A little freaky. I still like the freaky, but I like being different. If you couldn't tell, but I would like it to be something that, you know, I'm not negatively impacted, but I know a lot of people I care about. I'd rather them be able to be themselves and feel comfortable with it.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining me and Baron in a conversation about BDSM. If you'd like to continue to learn, share, and grow, please subscribe to this channel to get more content just like this. And don't forget that you can totally support me on Patreon. Your support really means a lot to me right now. So thank you so much if you want to continue to see these things. I want to make this project larger than it is, so I would like to take it other places. So hey, support me on Patreon if you want to see that happen. All right, I will see you guys next week. And until next time, bye.
Bye.